few days ago, a man you've almost certainly never heard of named Dennis Jackson died. And Dennis was a University of Delaware journalism professor when I was at the school in the early to mid-1990s. And he hated me. He hated my attitude, my approach, my philosophy. He literally told me when I was a senior that I was the worst editor he'd seen at the school newspaper. And that shit hurt. It was mean and it was cruel and it was nasty. But sitting here 30 years later, I also understand that Dennis was someone who loved journalism so much and loved Delaware so much that anyone or anything that seemed to be damaging the program was, in his eyes, garbage. And if I'm being honest, his words also inspired me. I wanted to prove Dennis Jackson wrong, to show him that I wasn't what he thought I was. So, sitting here a few days after his passing, I want to honor Dennis Jackson by thanking him. Yes, he probably cared a little too much, but that passion helped me tremendously. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers Sing and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Curry Kirkpatrick, the all-time great college hoops and tennis writer for Sports Illustrated and ESPN The Magazine. This is episode number 363. Let's sing some Yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks and you smell like Jack Sigma's armpit.
Well, Curry, I'm an enormous fan of your career and your writing. Let me start with this. In my mind, sitting here at age 52, having worked at Sports Illustrated and having been a journalist for a while, I consider you a quote-unquote legendary journalist. And I feel like as I get older, people will say to me, oh, man, I've been reading you for years. Oh, man, you're like a, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I wonder to you, does that feel weird? Do you not feel like you've earned that? Do you still feel like you're 25 and should be writing? Like, how does that make you feel?
It used to make me feel weird. And now it's very flattering. And it's very, it kind of keeps me, it makes me think I'm still relevant, which is not true, but it kind of makes me feel relevant still. Because, I mean, people think, you know, people think I'm still writing there. I mean, they say, oh, I read your story and, you know, a couple of years ago. And really, it was like 30 years ago. I only really got to be recognizable, I think, is when I started, you know, doing television after I'd left. Well, I started doing TV while I was still at SI doing a lot of CBS stuff. But then when I left and I went to ESPN and then I did a lot of stuff for ESPN TV, you know, on features and stuff and worked on game day and all that stuff. Then I think people recognized me a lot more, like in airports and stuff like that. That was when it became obvious to me that, you know, television just is a whole different show, a whole different, you know, horse you're riding here. The fun part is, as I said, it kind of makes me feel relevant, like I'm still doing stuff, which I'm really not. Like a guy came up to me on the beach the other day. I live on the beach in Hilton Head in South Carolina. And, you know, there are a lot of people wander on the beach and stuff. And a guy came up and he was a friend of a neighbor who lives here, but he was from out of town and he was from Iowa. And he just came up and introduced himself. And I said, hi. And he said, I just wanted to meet you. I've been reading, you know, he's staying in the present tense. I've been reading your stories, you know, since I was a little boy. Of course, that makes me feel old, but it kind of makes me happy that I was doing something that people got a kick out of, got fun out of it. You know, as a writer, when you're doing it, you never know if people are reading it or if they like it. But it's a connection that when people still do that, it makes me feel like I really, you know, I did something.
Is it weird to you when people say, like, speak of reading you, having read you in the current, in the present tense? Do you have any impulse to correct them and say, listen, that's actually impossible?
No, I do not correct them. But they're just saying, so I've been reading, and that what they meant is, What they mean is, I read you for a long time or something like that. I don't know.
Right.
Actually, some people do come up. I've had people come up and said, you know, I saved the magazines and I've read, you know, I know you've been gone for a long time, but I read a couple of your stories recently and they still stand up or something like that.
So I have in front of me October 28th, 1961, the Daily Tar Heel, byline Curry Kirkpatrick, headline Booters Meet Maryland here at 2, lead the North Carolina soccer team, fresh from its finest performance of the year last Tuesday when they whipped the Davidson Wildcats 2-0, move up to the big leagues this afternoon as they take on the perennial champions of the Atlantic Coast Conference, the University of Maryland Terrapins. The visitors have not been beaten in the ACC since 1959. And I guess my question for you, Curry, is did a 19, 20, 18, whatever year old Curry Kirkpatrick have any remote clue what he was doing when he was a young, aspiring writer at North Carolina in the early 1960s?
No, I don't think so. I think, as I recall, the men's soccer team was like the first, quote, beat I had. I mean, that's some fabulous writing that you just spoke about, right? So is your question, did I know what I was doing? Actually, no, probably no, because I didn't do any writing in high school. I'm unlike a lot of people. I think I'm unlike a lot of writers that you've probably spoken to and yourself. I didn't do any writing in high school. I wasn't interested in it. I don't know why. You know, there was a school paper, but I didn't do anything. I took English. I did essays and stuff. But it was only when I got to college that I went to North Carolina somewhat because they had a terrific journalism school, and Duke did not. I mean, I was going to go to Duke when I went down there to visit. And I guess I had journalism in the back of my mind, so they had a journalism school at Chapel Hill, and I got interested in the Daily Tar Heel. That was the student newspaper's everyday newspaper at that time. And, I just went up there and they said, well, what do you like? And I said, well, you know, I like sports. I play sports and all that stuff. And the guy said, well, why don't you go do a story on the soccer team or the soccer game, or, you know, go do a story on the cross country meet. And, I had no idea what I was doing. You're actually right that I kind of went and, you know, did it as I read a lot. I'll tell you, I read a lot of, I say I didn't write a lot. I read a lot of sports writing in high school and college, you know, Sports Illustrated and Sport Magazine and newspapers. I read, you know, the university had a library where you could get, you know, the New York Times and LA papers and Washington papers. And I read a lot of sports writers. So I guess maybe that's how I learned.
So you're at North Carolina and you write for the Daily Tar Heel for 4 years and you pitch SI while you're there. You offer some suggestions while you're at the newspaper. And then correct me if I'm wrong, your senior year of college at North Carolina, 21 going on 22, SI offers you a job?
Yeah. Yeah. At that time, the magazine had college stringers around the country who, they were college kids mostly. Some of them were local newspaper guys that would send in story ideas that they thought the magazine might be interested in. And I did a few of those, and I guess they liked what I sent in. I don't know. I got a couple of faces in the crowd. I remember that. I had a lacrosse player from North Carolina. I got him in face in the crowd. And as a matter of fact, Jeff, I was printed in the magazine before I got to college. I wrote two letters to the editor at Sports Illustrated that got published. You know, that didn't give me any connection there. But my senior year, it was Christmas break, and the magazine, I was at home then. And an editor called and said, we want you to come to New York, and we were having a lot of the stringers come in, and we're going to show them the magazine and show them how we work and meet some of the editors and blah, blah, blah. So, I went, showed up in the morning, and they showed me around a little bit. And then I went into the assistant manager, managing editor's office. And I'm sitting there across his desk, and he said, you know, we have an opening, one of our reporters. And in those days, a reporter, you know, did like odd jobs and corrected, you know, did interviews for writers, and they didn't write anything. They were young men and women who were, you know, they were in their mid-20s and stuff, I guess. But anyway, they said, we have an opening. And they said, you know, we'd be interested in you coming to work here. And, you know, after I got off the floor, I was just dumbfounded. And I said, well, you know, I stumbled around about, well, okay. That's why, you know, I said, I graduate in June. Can I come up then? And they said, well, no, we need you right now. I mean, it was like they needed a body, you know, they just needed a body to come in and fill in for this guy. I think a guy was drafted and they need somebody to take his place. And he said, look, I know it's a big decision. Why don't you go home, you know, talk to your folks and stuff. But I need an answer, you know, in the next 2 days. So I went home and, you know, I really loved school. I love the university. I love Chapel Hill. And, you know, I love being a student there. And I was, you know, I'm 4 months or whatever from graduating. And, you know, I said, I just, you know, I called them up. And I, you know, what was I, 21 or something? And I turned down a job at Sports Illustrated. And I did say, I said, listen, I really appreciate it. Listen, when I do graduate in the spring, you know, will the openings will still be there? And the guy said, well, no, we don't know about that. You know, because we need you now. And thank you. And, you know, hung up. So that was that. And then in the fall, after I graduated in the fall, I went back home to Niagara Falls, New York. And I got a call in September, October, I can't remember. They called again and said, we do have an opening. Will you come now? So I couldn't get on the plane fast enough.
In between that gap, you were writing for the Buffalo Evening News.
Where do you get your information? Wow, great.
I cannot reveal my sources, but when you're sitting there and yeah, you have your degree, but you turn down a job from this amazing magazine and you're sitting there covering City Hall and doing Cops Blotter for the Buffalo Evening News. Are you thinking, that's right, I really screwed this one up?
I don't think I sat around bemoaning that. I can't really remember because I didn't really know that they'd ever call me back. So I didn't have that in my mind. It wasn't like I was waiting for another call. But I don't remember sitting around thinking, you know, this is the end of my life. I knew then that I didn't want to work on a newspaper, though. You know, I wanted to do magazine writing, and I figured out, you know, at some point I'm going to do something else beside this. Then when they called, it was a spectacular opening and opportunity. And I just loved it, going to New York and working with these few young people that were actually my age, but they were, you know, they were called reporters. And then you moved up to become a writer reporter, which meant you wrote a couple of things. But, you know, I was there a couple of years before I really got anything in the magazine. You know, I was working, you know, behind the scenes, helping put stories together for writers. That's when I met Frank and Dan and all these folks that would become my mentors. You know, I mean, it was these idols, you know, these people you read and just were dumbfounded at what they could write, and you met them and now they were mentors rather than idols, which is kind of neat. When I was in school, I was still in school, and it was one night it was probably my junior year, maybe my sophomore year, I don't know. It was a Carolina basketball game and I'm in the stands. I wasn't down on press row for some reason. I guess it was, I wasn't writing for the Tario at that point, but and I looked down and there was this guy standing behind the bench during warmups, and he was taking notes, and he had this amazing hair, and he's this tall, great, he looked like Clark Gable, a young Clark Gable. And I looked down, and the more I looked, I said, you know, I said, that's Frank DeFord. I figured it out. And I've never seen anybody so cool. And I'm sitting up there. I remember this to this day. I'm sitting up there in the stands, and I saw Frank, and he's like the coolest guy I'd ever seen. And I said, you know what? That's what I want to do. That's who I want to be. And sure enough, I mean, I remember that to this day. And I told him years later, but I mean, he became my best friend at the magazine, and we lived in the same town in Connecticut, Westport. Our daughters grew up together. And, I mean, he was just my, you know, all time best guy at the magazine.
What about Frank DeFord, you know, was, did that for you?
You know, even back then I kind of admired how people dressed, and, he was just so stylish. He had on an outfit. I don't even remember what it was like. It was like Savile Row meets Hollywood and Vine. It was just this spectacular, cool style, and just his way. I mean, I wasn't even down there talking to him. I don't even remember. I think the first time I talked to him was when I went to the magazine. But I don't know. He just, and of course, I'd been a fan of his. He was only like 2 years older than me. I mean, you know, he went to Sports Illustrated right out of Princeton and started writing these amazing college basketball stories. That's when I was reading him. And he covered Bill Bradley in Princeton that year. And everything Frank wrote, I just thought it was spectacular. You know, this, and he was so young and so great. And, you know, I remember seeing him from up there and thinking, and then when I met him, I mean, he's the kind of guy, you know, he walked in the room and he commanded the room. I mean, he's just by look, he was very, very tall. And he just had this great look and style about him. And he was very kind and generous. And I mean, I can't stop saying enough words about Frank DeFord.
I feel like for modern writers, especially writers younger than me, writers in their 20s and 30s, it is very hard to picture what it was you walked into at Sports Illustrated in the early to mid 1960s, what it was like, what that world was like, what that universe was like, what it meant to be at Sports Illustrated at that time. And I'm going to just throw that big softball at you. What was it like to be working at Sports Illustrated in the 1960s?
Well, the magazine was in the Time Life building, which is right in the center of New York and Rockefeller Center. And, the magazine was on one, we had one whole floor of this huge building for editorial. The rest of the magazine, the advertisers and all the other stuff were on other floors. So it was just the magazine on the one floor. And we had two aisles on each side of the building that went down, and there were cubicles and offices and stuff. And when I first started, you know, I was in a cubicle with three or four other guys and girls, and, you know, we would party and stuff. And it was, you know, and down the hall, though, when I first got a little office, a cubicle, I was right across the hall from Frank DeFord, and Dan Jenkins was two doors down, and Roy Blunt was, you know, across the hall down the way, and Mark Cramp. I mean, I'm talking about legendary writers at Sports Illustrated. There I was, and I just kind of sat around watching these people and listening to them and learning. And it really was a great learning experience. And then being in New York in the 60s, all kinds of things were going on. And I lived on the East Side. And so we had hot and cold running stewardesses going on around in our building. And I could walk to work. I mean, I could walk past, you know, this. I didn't even know New York till I got there. I'd never been to New York. But it was, Jeff, it was a spectacular experience being, you know, a young guy in his 20s in New York. I hate New York now. I hate when I go back there. But it was so exciting. I mean, I could hardly concentrate sometimes on when I go to work and, you know, I had a job. But so much was going on in the city around me that, you know, and at night, and it was something.
It's funny. I have a story in front of me from the Louisville Courier Journal from March 16th, 1972. And the lead is, Henry Bacon sat in Chicago's O'Hare Airport yesterday and debated with Sports Illustrated writer Curry Kirkpatrick. Kirkpatrick wasn't present And Bacon was passing through on his way to tonight's NCAA Midwest Regional Basketball semifinal game, matching Louisville and Southwestern Louisiana. But Kirkpatrick's opinion that tonight would be, quote, the end of the road for U of L was fresh on the newsstand. And Bacon, a senior guard for Louisville, who's just coming into his own, was on his soapbox. Nah, said Bacon, that's all wrong. He thinks we can't play just because we lost to Memphis twice. Well, I think we're going to beat those guys. We'll show him. And it's funny, like, nowadays, nobody would be like, whoa, this writer for a magazine, like, that would be an article in a newspaper that a writer from a magazine predicted a team would lose. But it feels like you guys carried such weight that Louisville's, you know, Henry Bacon being mad at you actually mattered. Were you aware of the weight that the magazine and the words you put in the magazine, were you aware of what that carried?
Yeah, I actually became well aware, especially, you know, doing college basketball. It was like a beat for me. I do a story almost every week on something somewhere in college basketball. And I got to understand, because I'd go to games and people would recognize me and come up and say, I love this story last week or whatever. And teams would know me. People would, players would know my name, who I was, you know, because of reading the magazine. The magazine was so popular in those days. Well, you know, it was the only, there was no ESPN. There was no internet, obviously. It was the internet and ESPN and all that, all in one, in a magazine that came out once a week. And I think this is probably true of a lot of the other writers who covered a certain sport and did a lot of stuff in that sport, that the players and coaches and people in that sport that they covered knew the writer. If they didn't know him personally, they knew him, you know, to go up and say hello or talk to him. And I got that a lot. I became, you know, well aware of that. I remember that Southwestern Louisiana team, you know, and I was so wrong on them because I thought they were going to run through the tournament, and because they were scoring like 120 points a game. Of course, they didn't play defense, but I had done a big story on them earlier in the season and fell in love with the place and the people. And I wrote this funny story about the Raging Cajuns or whatever they're called. And I picked them. I think I picked them to go to the Final Four. I might have picked them to win the whole thing. I don't know. I mean, I've had people come up and quote lines back to me that I wrote and that I don't even remember, which is kind of thrilling. It's kind of neat.
I've been having that happen more and more. Remember that story you did? And I'm like, no, I do not remember that story.
yes.
I think of you first and foremost as a college basketball writer. I know you did all different things, but I think of you first and foremost as a college basketball writer. If you look back at your time at SI covering college basketball, and I said to you, who would be your number one go-to guy through the years? Who was your go-to coach or go-to player from your time covering college hoops? Who would your guy be?
Well, it'd probably be Jim Valvano. I ended up doing his book.
Right.
So I had done a big piece on him, and then we became friends, and then, you know, he asked me to do his book. So it would probably be him, because he was the funniest, the guy made everybody around him happy. He's one of these people who made everybody happy. He was always on, and when Jim got cancer, that was long after, you know, we had done his book, and I'd done stories on him, so I didn't know him. I didn't see him that much then, but before that, he was the most upbeat person. I guess, you know, another guy in that realm would be Al McGuire. Al McGuire was spectacular, quote, and character, and, you know, off the beaten path. He was just a very odd, weird, great guy to be around and write about.
What was Bobby Knight like to deal with?
Well, what kind of words can we use on here? Can we use asshole?
You can use fucking asshole if you'd like to. You can use anything you want.
There you go. Well, that's what he was. No, I think he was a bad guy. I really think he was a bad guy at heart. I had totally ups and downs with him. You know, he threw me out of practices several times. He threatened me all this, you know, a lot of times. And then on other occasions when I'd come around to a story, he was very nice to me. That's what made him kind of crazy. I say kind of. I think, you know, he was absolutely not. I don't know how much you want me to go into this, but the first time a magazine had me go out was the It was the year that they were about to go undefeated. The 75 team, I went out to do a story on the team, and Knight, this big story. And Knight was a friend of another guy in the magazine, this older guy named Merv Hyman, who had been with the magazine since its inception. And he knew Knight at Army, and so he was a buddy of Knight. And Hyman called up Knight and said I was coming out. So I go out, and I meet with Knight in his office, and he said, you can come to practice, but I don't want, don't talk to my players. I just want, I'll let you in practice. And then we'll have dinner tonight. And I say, oh, great. So went to practice, and before practice, some of the players came out, and Quinn Buckner came out, who was on the USA World Team the previous summer. So I had met him. I knew him. He was, apart from Knight, I just knew him on a different level. And so I was talking to him, and actually Quinn came over to talk to me, and Knight came in at the other end of the gym with a couple of his cronies. He used to do this. He loved to embarrass writers, and especially me, in front of his cronies. And he starts screaming at me, Kirkpatrick, you motherfucker, I told you not to talk to my players. Get the fuck out of here. And so he threw me out, before we even done. So I go back to the hotel room and start packing. And Merv Hyman calls me from New York, his SI guy. And he said, I heard you and Bobby had a confrontation. I said, yeah, your guy is a total nutcase. And he said, well, wait there. In 10 minutes, Bobby's going to come around the hotel and pick you up and go to dinner. And sure enough, here he came. He came 10 minutes and rang my room and said, come down, meet me in the lobby. So I did that. And, we went out to dinner, got a lot of stuff from him, went to his house afterward. And I met his then wife. And, I wrote about some stuff in the house that infuriated him. The story came out. He was infuriated. And he wrote this long letter. He had one of his henchmen write a long letter to the magazine saying Kirkpatrick will never be allowed back here and blah, blah, blah. And one of the things, listen to this, Jeff, one of the things he was really upset about was his wife had these little shelves in the kitchen, with little knickknacks on them. Uh-huh. And one of the knickknacks was a little square thing. It said, my Bob sexy, that she'd made and put it in there. So I put that in the story to humanize this guy. It was a nice little domestic thing. He was furious. He said that anything you did and saw and was in the house was off the record, and this is bullshit. And I mean, that's one of the things he put in his letter. So, Dan Rather of CBS 60 Minutes once did a piece on Knight, and they couldn't get apparently any coaches or writers to get the other side of how Knight was a maniac and an asshole. So they called me. So I did an interview with Rather, and, I gave the negative side of Knight. And one of the things I said was, Rather asked me, there was all these rumors every year about Knight going to the NBA. And he asked me, what do you think about Coach Knight if he went to the National Basketball Association? I said, well, he'd last about 3 days because a couple of players would punch him in the face. And so, the interview went like that. So it was the negative side of Knight. But the next time I saw him was at a regional, I think, in the NCAA. And he's walking towards me with Pete Newell, the old coach who was one of his mentors. Well, I knew Pete Newell really well. And Pete Newell liked me and he liked Bobby. And he always said, you guys should get together. But so here Newell and Knight come. And this is right after the 60 Minutes. And I thought, oh, this is going to be nice. And Knight came up to me and shook hands and grabbed me like, he hadn't seen me in 30 years and really nice to me. So I think that was because Newell was there and he didn't want to, offend Newell by, going after me. I don't know. But there are all kinds of things like that, he was Mr. Nice Guy to me and then he was Mr. Terrible.
Who's the best college basketball player you ever saw?
In college?
Yeah.
Bill Walton.
How come?
And I say that, with all due respects to Kareem, I just thought Walton, his all-around play was so good and so reliable and so steady throughout 3 years. And, he couldn't play as a freshman. you know, I just watched that all, and I did so many stories on him. You know, Kareem, the only story I ever did on Kareem, I was still a really young guy at the magazine. He won three in a row, three NCAAs in a row. And after he won his final game in Louisville, the NCAA finals in Louisville, I went up to his hotel room, and I did a whole story on kind of the end of his career, his college career. And he's very, very nice to me. And so I wrote that story. That's the only thing I ever did on him in college. But now we're in the NBA. The magazine had me do the NBA for 4 years. Mm-hmm. And they took me out of college and put me in the NBA. And I didn't like it as much. But anyway, I did it. And one of the years was the year Walton and the Trailblazers won the championship. And they played the Lakers in one of the earlier rounds. And Walton swept, Portland Trailblazers swept the Lakers, Walton outplaying Jabbar. So they put the headline on the cover. The headline on the cover was Portland beats Los Angeles, Walton outduels Jabbar. You know, I don't do the headline, but that's what the story, but I wrote about that because he did. And so now the next NBA preseason, I go out to do some preseason stories, and I went to the Lakers training camp, and I go see Kareem, and he's in his locker room. He sees me coming. He turns around, faces the locker, and he won't even face me. I go up and I say, Kareem, it's Corey Kirkpatrick. How are you doing? Could I get some few quotes about the next season? He wouldn't even say anything. He wouldn't turn around and do anything. And the players told me Kareem is really pissed at the cover. He said, Walton didn't outduel me. You know, it's up these guys, as you know, Jeff, you've had to deal with these guys. They're all crazy.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, when Walton played, you know, I have a hard time, best player in college. The game that Walton lost his last game to David Thompson of North Carolina State, who was Jordan before Jordan. I mean, David Thompson was a spectacular, great college player. So I kind of hesitate. He'd be in those top three or four.
In your career, did you ever feel like a athlete or coach or someone was literally going to punch you or threaten physical violence on you?
That's a great question. Ironically, I had that happen in tennis a couple of times more than in college basketball or pro basketball. That time that I went in to see Kareem, he wouldn't turn around. You know, I was afraid he was going to turn around, you know, blast me. But so that might have been one of the times. But do you want to hear my story about the tennis player?
Sure.
Well, it was John McEnroe, another total a-hole. I had done a story when he was very, very young, just starting. I think I did the first national story on McEnroe. I went to Milan, Italy to do this story, and he was cooperative. He talked to me. He was very nice. And he was just a young kid at the time. He probably was 19. And one of the lines I had in the story, I called him Shanty Irish. Al McGuire always told me there were two kinds of Irish. There were shanty Irish, who were, you know, from the other side of the tracks in blue collars. And there was lace curtain Irish. So I called McEnroe shanty Irish. So the next time I see him is a Davis Cup match in Grenoble, France. And it's outside. He comes up. He did a press conference. He comes up. There were only a few USA journalists there. And Bud Collins, a couple other guys. And he's up there. So we go over to talk to him after his main press conference. And we're staying there. And here he comes. He's with a couple of USDA guys. And as he gets close to me, he says, Kirkpatrick, you motherfucker. That's the worst thing ever written about me. And he lunges. He lunges at me. He wants to go. And the USDA guys grab him. I mean, he's not bigger than me. I think I could take him at that time. But he wants some of me. And he lunges, and they stop him from lunging. And he says, that's the worst thing anybody ever wrote about me. And I said something, you know, witty, like, well, if that's the worst thing you ever had, you know, you're a very lucky guy. And he sort of came at me again, and they yelled him back and let him off. And he referred to the shanty Irish. And I guess, you know, his father's parents were very well-to-do lawyers and Wall Street lawyers. And they were really offended by the shanty Irish line. I never did that again. I think it was probably improper use because, you know, the real Irishman, that's like, you know, that's like for blacks using the N-word. And yeah. So I think I learned something. But I didn't apologize to him because I used to write, you know, I had to write, Jeff, I, you know, the guy won all the majors. I had to write all the big stories at Wimbledon and I wrote about his first Wimbledon championship and the year he almost got thrown out of Wimbledon. I had to write about all this stuff, bad stuff about him. And I tried to do it in a, you know, funny way. But, yeah, we never got along. Although I did get along with, you know, the other board, the Beckers and the Lendels and the, even Jimmy Connors.
Before we continue with Two Riders Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman. I'm here with my son, Emmett, who's really enjoying watching me write my Tupac Shakur biography.
Dad, what does I'm a fucking failure, fraud, piece of shit, douchebag, ho dickwad, and I'll never accomplish anything mean?
What?
I heard you say that yesterday while you were sobbing in a fetal position under your desk.
Yeah, that must have been someone else.
It was you in your office with your girlish whimper.
What's your point?
My point is, you always do this when you have a book to, and there's only one solution. Let's go to royalretros.com and pick out some great throwback USFL gear. Maybe that sweet Chicago Blitz hat you've been eyeing, or a cool Sam Mills Baltimore Stars jersey.
Huh, will that help me finish my book?
No, but you'll stop crying like a little bitch.
In 1991, you wrote a piece, Playing in the Bush League, where you basically went to Kennebunkport, Maine, and did all a bunch of different sports with George Bush, Bush Sr. That is just a weird kind of story that would never, ever, ever happen in 2024. You wouldn't have the access. It just wouldn't happen. They wouldn't spend to do it. What do you remember about that?
Now, you got to remember, though, a few years ago, Obama gave a lot of access to ESPN. They'd come over and he'd do his picks for the Final Four. Remember? And Andy Katz would go and he'd go in the Oval Office and they'd have a big board and Obama would give his picks. Now, as far as a story like that, you're probably right. Yeah. Although we've had, I think Reagan was on the cover with Ewing one time. I'm trying to think of our presidential covers. And I think other guys have done stories about, I don't know, about presidents, their love of sports. My story that week was on his vacation, you know, what he did on vacation, you know, all the sports that he did. I had a source that was in the White House, and I called him because we had this idea to do it up at Kennebunkport. And it's funny, the summer before this story appeared, we were going to do it. And the Arab war broke out or something, and he wasn't going to Kennebunkport. So the whole thing was canceled. And I thought we'd never get to do it, but we did do it the following year. I had, you know, he wanted me to come to the Oval Office, which I did, and talk to me about the story and sort of meet me and figure out who I was and all this stuff. And I had these funny exchanges with him because, you know, he's a really avid tennis player and I played tennis a lot. So he said, you know, we're going to play tennis up at the house in Maine. And we're going to play some doubles. He said, I got to check you out because I don't know if I want to play against you or with you. And so he and Barbara were good friends with Chris Evert. And they said, we're going to call Chris. And Barbara's going to call Chris and check you out. I said, well, you know, you can call. I said, Mr. President, I invented Chris Evert. You know, and he laughed, you know, because I'd done stories on her when she was 15. So, yeah, so he liked the fact that I could play. So I played with him. The amazing story that I take from that experience, Jeff, you know, along with meeting the president, being in the Oval Office and all that stuff, was I wrote the story up in Kennebunkport, and I go home, and it's Sunday afternoon. And, of course, we did not guarantee the cover, but it was just understood he was going to be in the cover. You know, we have this unbelievable 4-day access of President of the United States, and nobody else does. And we had this great photos of him doing everything, playing golf to tennis to the horseshoes to – you know, out on his boat. He took me out on the boat and stuff like that. So I'm back. I've done the story. They call me on Sunday afternoon. The magazine said, we got good news and bad news. I said, well, they said, good news, we love the story. Bad news is president's not going to be on the cover. And I'm sitting here. I said, what? What do you mean he's not going to be on the cover? They said, well, a guy from Arkansas, an unknown Arkansas golfer came out of nowhere to win the PGA today, and we're putting John Daly, I'm serious, on the cover. So they put John Daly on the cover, and they have a little photo of Bush up in the right top right of the magazine, the wow. president at play. It's unbelievable. I think of this now, of course, John Daly, but, every time I see Daly, I think of this. So I have there's only two people have the original cover that we shot. I have it and George Bush has it. So that's kind of neat.
Wow. Recently on this podcast, we had a pretty long discussion. I was talking with Jack McCallum about this, and Mark Mulvoy, about the famous or infamous Bag It Michael cover with Michael Jordan swinging and missing a baseball, and how he never talked to SI for the rest of his, hasn't talked to it since.
Yeah, it was Steve Wolf, right?
Yeah, Steve Wolf's article was...
Steve Wolf wrote the story, yeah.
Would you say John Daly over Bush was as egregious a cover mishap?
Oh, I would call it worse, but, I wouldn't even have it the same. I mean, it's a kind of different circumstance, but, I think there have been other egregious covers we've had, but the Jordan baseball one is a good one. My cover wasn't even a cover.
In 1992, you got people mad at you. You wrote a piece about Christian Laettner, who was a star at Duke at the time, and you sort of addressed the rumors that he was gay, which were going around. And if you do a Google search, there's a lot of like Laettner and his family mad at you. And I wonder, looking back 32 years later, were they right?
Well, what's his name that works for CBS, the Duke guy?
Seth Davis?
Yeah. He wrote about it, and whoever he was writing for then, I don't know. He spent a great deal of time writing about that. The reason I used it, I asked Christian about it. I mean, he was very upfront about it. If you read the quotes, I can't remember now. I don't have it in front of me. But if you read the section, I just asked him about it, and he kind of joked about it, didn't deny anything. But he and his teammate would go around, like holding hands, and they'd do stuff like that just as a joke. So I wrote about that like that. I mean, I didn't treat it as anything serious at all.
Yeah.
The ironic part of that, Jeff, is that when I went down to do a story on Christian, of course, I'm a North Carolina guy, and anything I wrote about Duke was always, Duke people always went nuts, went crazy. I mean, my stories about Coach K, I could tell you some stories about him. But so being a North Carolina guy, I kind of bent over backward to beat, and I covered all the Duke championships in those days. I wrote about Laettner and Hurley and Grant Hill. Grant Hill is still a good friend of mine, I would say, when I see him. And Laettner as well. I see Laettner almost every Final Four at the Naismith Hall of Fame breakfast on Sunday after the Saturday night finals. I see Laettner almost every year. But let me tell you this story. So Laettner and I are talking. He went to a prep school in Buffalo called Nichols School. And I went to prep school in Niagara Falls, New York. I went to a small boys' school called DeVoe. Mm-hmm. And we used to play Nichols in sports, all the sports. We weren't the same league. We were a lot smaller. But we played them in baseball and basketball and stuff. So it turned out, I was trying to figure out the years I was at DeVoe. And it turned out that Mrs. Laettner, Christian's mom, was at Nichols. She went to Nichols also the same years I was at DeVoe. So we figured out that she must have seen Mrs. Laettner saw me play like basketball and baseball when we go to Buffalo and play Nichols. And I talked to her on the phone. He gave me her phone number. And so that's how I got to know her on the phone. And she was very funny. And, after the story appeared, I don't remember any feedback from the family I got personally, and even from Christian. He, to this day, he's never mentioned that to me, that part of the story that I guess everybody was upset at. You read the rest of the story, and I'm sure it was all, hosannas. And I mean, he was their star player, one of the great players in college history, really. His numbers show it. But, if there was really serious feedback to me, from Duke people, I would remember it. I think since then there's been more serious Duke versus Kirkpatrick stories.
Who did you enjoy covering more as a journalist, Coach K or Dean Smith?
Well, wait a minute. You know, it was difficult to cover Dean Smith because, as I say, I was at the magazine and I was a North Carolina guy. And, you know, I'd have to be really objective. And he would always, you know, I didn't have any ins to Dean Smith. I never got any, you know, information or scoops or anything like that. In fact, he would, you know, this is a old story. I'm sure you know this story, but when Jordan was a freshman, we wanted to put the whole team on the cover. You know, the North Carolina who's going to win the championship. And Dean refused to let Jordan appear on the cover. So it was just the four other players and Dean. Do you remember that?
I didn't know that, actually.
Oh, yeah. In fact, the magazine did a replica of that cover a couple of years ago with when Baycott, you know, when they were coming off the second place finish. Mm-hmm. And they had all five starters and Hubert Davis on the cover. And it was a replica of the Dean Smith cover. So anyway, he wouldn't allow, and he told us at the time, he said, no North Carolina freshman will ever be on the cover of Sports Illustrated. I mean, it's this deal, you know, freshmen were in their place and they didn't deserve to have that kind of attention. And that was his, you know, one of his rules.
Right.
And, so, you know, story by story, when I did them, I think I'd bent over backward to be objective. I think when North Carolina played bad, you know, I write about him bad, and but he would always. So then 2 years after that, after Jordan's cover, maybe more than that, 3 or 4 years after that, North Carolina had a freshman center. We put a great cover picture of him on the cover dunking over somebody. And it was the preparation cover going into the NCAA tournament. You know, it was an action picture. It was at a game. So we didn't need Dean Smith's approval. So now I go to the NCAA first round in the Meadowlands and his first press conference, the NCAA first round. And Dean comes in for his presser and there's thousands, you know, not thousands, but the whole huge press corps there. And I'm sitting in there and he starts a press conference and they started asking a question. He said, no, wait a minute. I want to address something. And he looked right at me and he said, Curry, oh, I know. We called this guy, the cover billing of this guy said, and again, I can't remember his name. Let's say his name was Joe Adams. Joe Adams, Carolina's main man. That was the cover billing. So Dean looks at me and he said, Curry, you're a North Carolina guy. You know, no freshman is ever North Carolina's main man. I mean, he gives, you know, I sort of shrink into my chair. I mean, there's all these, you know, writers and broadcasters. So, I mean, he nailed me for that. Then he nailed me for other stuff. Then he wouldn't give me that much access as everybody thought. When he was, after he was retired, ESPN gave him some award, you know, at their, might have been that Arthur Ashe Courage Award, something like that. And they wanted me to, I was doing stuff for ESPN TV then. They wanted me to go over and, you know, interview him, do him, you know, 3 minutes for some sound bites for his award. And because they knew I knew him and all that. So I call him up and he hates to talk about himself. And I knew this was going to be difficult. And he said, well, okay, Curry, I'll give you 5 minutes. So I thought, great. So we have the Cram crew over there and we're sitting there and I'm asking him these hard questions about himself that I know he doesn't want to answer and is very uncomfortable. And he keeps looking at his watch the whole time. And I got to, it must have been like 4:58 or something. And I started to ask him a question and he interrupted me. He said, Curry, that's five. He looked at his watch. That's five. That's it. And he got middle of my question and he got up. And he took his lavalier mic off and shook my hand and said, great seeing you. How's the family? He knew my family. He knew their names. He asked about them and then walked out. I mean, that's the kind of relationship we had. Now, to Coach K, again, I did some wonderful stories on Duke teams. I mean, I don't remember ever doing anything that he was really upset at me personally until I was at ESPN Magazine then, the summer that the first three Duke players left early for the NBA. You know, Duke was kind of on a pedestal where nobody would ever leave Duke, you know, to go to the pros.
Yeah.
Where when it was all happening. So they finally had a summer, and it was Elton Brand and William Avery and Corey Maggette. They all left. And Kay was really pissed, and it was a huge deal at Duke. You know, all these guys are going and leaving this wonderful Duke University and blah, blah, blah. So that summer, ESPN Magazine said, look, Curry, I want you to go do a story with Kay and ask him what it was like and how's he feeling and blah, blah, blah. And I said, wait a minute. You know, first of all, you're not going to do that. Secondly, can you get somebody else to do it? You know, they know that this North Carolina thing with me. And Krzyzewski isn't going to want to talk to me about that. And they said, no, you know him really well. You should do it, blah, blah, blah. So I call up the Duke people, and they say, you know, Coach isn't going to do that. But they say, well, ask him to get back. So long story short, they call me, and Krzyzewski says he'll give me 5 minutes. He was going to be at an Indiana high school all-star game. Mm-hmm. So I go and meet him, and we're sitting in a gym all by ourselves on these two gym chairs. And I had talked to the three other players before I did this. And William Avery had told me that when he and his mom went in to tell Kay that he was leaving, Kay was really angry, and he looked over at William Avery's mom, and he said, do you know your son is fucking my program? And I said, I asked William, I said, wait a minute, he did not say that to your mom. He said, no, he didn't. He said that exact words, and we were really upset. Then I talked to the mom on a phone call. I asked her the same thing. She said, oh, yeah, he said that. Wow. And we walked out, and it was really upset. So anyway, now I'm sitting with Kay, and I got 5 minutes. So I was asking him all these questions. I know it's a tough time, and they left. And, you know, he said, well, every individual, hey, you know, all this bullshit. Every individual has their own case. And I told him, you know, I was happy they left. I told Elton that he probably should go. It's all bullshit. But he told me that. So now I know I've only got, you know, one question. So now I asked him about the Avery thing. And I said, Mike, did you really say that to Miss Avery? And he looked at me and said, here's, you know, this is a report. He said, who told you that? And I said, well, William Avery told me that, and his mother told me that, separate interviews. I said, did you really actually say that? And he looked at me again. And he said, Curry, he said, I talked to William just the way I talked to all my players. Period. Got up, said, thank you very much, walked out.
Wow.
So I said, fine. So I used that. I used it. Of course, I didn't use fuck, but, you know, we bleeped it. So I used that and a bunch of other stuff that he didn't like, which I knew he wouldn't. And so he gets the Duke SID to write a 5-page letter to the magazine pointing out 15 different things I got wrong. Off the record, got this wrong, got that wrong, you know, misinterpreted, all this stuff. I never said that, you know, to William, you know, it was all this stuff. And they said, oh, yeah. And then the letter said, Kirkpatrick will not be welcome with any press credential from now on at Duke Indoor Stadium.
Wow.
So, oh, yeah. So the next year they opened with DePaul, and we asked for credentials. Sure enough, they didn't give me credentials. So the magazine called the university and protested that and all that and bullshit. So I wasn't going to get a credential, but little did they know, one of my best friends was the athletic director at DePaul named Bill Bradshaw, who I grew up with. He then became the athletic director at Temple. And, he got me a ticket to sit right with him, right behind the DePaul bench. So Kay saw me over there, and the Duke people saw me over there, and they knew, you know, didn't give me credentials. So I think they were stunned I got in the building. Oh, I got one other thing about that. You know, when we did really get along, when Mike and his wife, Mickey, we did a sit-down interview about Jim Valvano and his cancer. And Valvano and Krzyzewski got very close toward the end of Jim's days. And Krzyzewski was, you know, instrumental in the cancer deal, the raising money. And so I went and did an interview with Mickey and Mike. And we sat, and this was after this incident with the, you know, you're fucking my program. And they couldn't have been nicer to me. They sat, you know, did the interview and so forth. And we never mentioned it. And so, you know, I don't know. I don't know what he thinks of me now. But the other day, Jeff, it was my birthday. I think I told you. So my son-in-law is a business guy in Boston, and he goes to all these celebrity events and social things. And he was at some meeting, and he leaves a video message for me, a happy birthday message. And he says, "Curry, happy birthday. I just want to put on somebody else on the line." And he hands the phone to Jay Williams, you know, the the former Duke player who's now an ESPN guy, who I knew really well, you know, back in the day. And even when I worked for ESPN, I knew Jay. And Jay gets on there and he says, "Curry, happy birthday. I understand it's your birthday. We here at Duke wish you all the best. And you can come down. You can come back to Duke Indoor Stadium now." So the thing still lingers, I guess.
Let me ask you a final question. You are 81. You just turned 81. And a lot of the people you referenced are no longer with us. Frank DeFord is no longer with us. Dan Jenkins. You mentioned Mark Cram, Dean Smith. And I wonder for you, what is it to have written for so long and to see both colleagues and the people you cover pass away?
Oh, wow. Well, it's very sad, obviously, because these were really, really good friends of mine. Dan's daughter, Sally's a good friend of mine. And of course, when Dan passed and then Frank passed, and I went to his funeral in Westport, and both of theirs dying really affected me. I mean, for days, as you can imagine. Because as I told you earlier, these were idols, heroes turned into mentors and friends, which is really a spectacular thing when you think about it.
Yeah.
And then I went to Dean's funeral, and I wrote SI.com wanted me to write a appreciation of Dean Smith, which I did for them, because I really don't write much anymore. But I was happy to do that and sad to do it. You know, it's funny, you mentioned this. The most recent death that affected me, which is very strange, but when O.J. died, just, you know, in the past few weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what. It almost ages you, and it makes you feel like, is your whole past life disappearing? You know, as bad a guy as that was, I knew OJ before the murders. I knew him as this great guy. I wrote about him at something called the Superstars, which was a superstar event that IMG had a long, long time ago. I got to know him there. And then, when the white Bronco happened, I was between working for Sports Illustrated and ESPN. I was working for Newsweek magazine then. And I was in a hotel room in New York about to do the NBA playoffs. And an editor called from Newsweek and said, "Curry, is your television on?" I said, "No." He said, "Turn it on." And it was a white Bronco rolling across the LA freeways into America's living rooms. Yeah. And I just watched, and they said, "Look, no NBA story. Stay there. We're going to send you a whole bunch of files. You're going to, you know," we did like eight, Newsweek did like eight stories on OJ that week. And my story was about Hollywood Babylon. It was a look back at all the Hollywood scandals of the past 50 years. And I had, you know, I called around, talked to lawyers and about the case that's going to happen. And so I had an affinity. I don't know if that's a word for OJ. I mean, a connection, mm-hmm. you know, both before and after. So when he dies, it's like, you know, your whole life is like disappearing. You know, and as you live, I don't know. And I mean, Frank and Dan both died a lot younger than I am. And so I don't know why I'm still alive, but, I'm in good health, knock on wood, stuff like that. But, you know, that's an amazing question. And I think, you know, when I think of it, it's an amazing thought that OJ would be included in that group of, you know, people you covered that died and people that were your, you know, peers. I mean, you're a young guy. Why would you think of something like that?
I think aging is a really trippy, I feel like you have to go through it to really understand it. And you look at people in their 20s and 30s. And I, you know, I said this to my wife recently. We used to be, so I'm 52, and we used to be friends with the people who are getting married. So you're either getting married or you're friends with the people who are getting married. And at the wedding, you're the young couples at the wedding. And then all of a sudden, you're the parents of friends of people getting married. And you're just in this different category. And it is weird. Yeah. I think aging, you always think you're going to be young until you're not. And one day you look and you're like, holy cow, I'm not young anymore.
Yeah.
I just find it really trippy and strange, you know?
I know exactly what you're saying. I think that came very late for me. I think I still considered I was young like 10 years ago. I probably... Yeah,
that's good.
No, I'm serious. I, you know, when I was writing, I stopped writing retired way too early. I mean, I wanted to, you know, I was tired of the travel, and I really, writing is a real chore for me. I don't know how it is for you, but it's very difficult for me. It always was. I was one of these guys that labored at it. You know, Frank also labored at it. Dan, on the other hand, was ridiculous. You know, he'd write a spectacular story, The Veranda of the Masters, in an hour and a half. I mean, you know, the legendary stories, you know, his first novel, Semi-Tough, you know, which he wrote on Hilton Head on summer vacation with me. He wrote it in about a month because he needed money, because Sally and the other kids were getting older and had to go to college. And he told me down there that year, I'll never forget this. He said, I have to write this book to get my kids through college. Of course, after he wrote it, he never had to write a word again in his life. But it's, you know, I think of these stories about these people who are now gone, and it's, you know, Bud Collins is another who was a great mentor for me in tennis. He had this spectacular funeral in Boston where every inch of the Boston society came to his funeral and, you know, told me what a great person this guy was, which, you know, these are the things you think about.
Yeah.
When people pass.
Well, Curry, I'm an enormous fan of your career and your writing.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so much. That's really nice of you.
I look forward to talking to you again.
Well, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
I want to thank today's guest, Curry Kirkpatrick, for joining me on Two Riders Sing the Yank. You can follow Curry nowhere, but go to the SI Vault and read his old work. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Riders Sing the Yank, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. It'd be really appreciated. Music is by the great MC Whiteout. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep riding.